accession number 27226, Reel 8.
Well, hook Reel 8.
Right. Well, in the interim time, we were doing other things necessary to develop your skills. And first of all, situations where you need to do a precautionary landing. And that is where you have all your faculties, you've got everything that's right, but you need to land for some reason. It could be the weather's down, it could be that it's the weather's closed, you've come down through low cloud, it could be foggy and you found a spot where you want to land. It could also, in later days, come to a situation where you're in water, flying over water, where you need to land on water, and it's fundamental that you go through the same precautionary proceedings. Precautionary landing is merely using finding a good field to land on. You go in high, you find the field, it wants to be a reasonable size, you know where the wind is, and that's always important when you're flying. Know where the wind is on the ground, and you can see this by smoke. It's always a good indicative. Smoke, chimneys, waves of water. You can see the waves blowing in a particular direction. When you see the direction, you're going to do a landing. You fly into the wind. Period. Bearing in mind that if you're doing a precautionary landing, you've control over it, but you're still coming down in a situation where you have some problems. You come in at a good speed, over the top of your stalling speed, with engine running nice and comfortably, and you come in slowly and gradually over the top of the field, close your engine, do an engineless landing, a three-point turn into the field and roll to a stop, period. If the engine goes, if your field is big enough and you feel confident enough and the actual emergency that caused the precaution has gone, or you've landed because you wanted to pick somebody up in a field, then take your aircraft back to the end of the field, downwind, sit the person in the back or whatever, open the throttle, stay, you can't stay on the brakes, of course I was thinking of the brakes, but in a normal aircraft you stay on the brakes, open your throttle wide until you've got all the power in the engine, then let your brakes off, go forward down the field, keep your airspeed, your aircraft down close to the ground, let your airspeed build up as fast as you can, and then if there's a hedge over there or a tree or anything like that, you have enough flying speed to pull over the top of it. Okay? So that's a precautionary landing. A forced landing is where you have no engine. No engine, then you look around for a field you can land on, bearing in mind that you're losing height all the time. It wants to be clear and clean with a good approach downwind. Know where the wind is. You check that your engine's actually on, that your petrol's on and everything is as it should be. In that case, you close your throttle. You can leave your throttle open, actually, because if it's due to petrol starvation, it might fire. Your propeller's going round and round and round, and you just do the standard gliding approach. Keep plenty of speed on, keep your nose down, and as you get near the ground, depending on the size of the field, so you approach nearer to the stalling speed. Bearing in mind that as you approach the stalling speed, in a tiger moth you have two wings, so you have no problem. If you feel it getting sloppy, you can always increase your speed by pushing your nose forward, but you're losing height, and height is something you want. So it would always pay for you if you're getting over a hedge and you're not certain where you're going to land. Do they go through the hedge or not? Bearing in mind you've got wheels, if you hit the hedge into the wheels, you're going to turn turtle anyway. It's possibly to push a stick forward, take off a lot of your height, get more speed, go straight towards the hedge, pull over the hedge, and then drop everything and go pyong, pong, pong. And you can get away with that in most aircraft, different with monoplanes, but that's another ball game. So that's forced landing, and they're the precautionary landings. You know, you dealt with those in a period of, till July, June anyway, where we're doing aerobatics, where you'd basic aerobatics, a spin, which everybody thinks is an aerobatic when they look at it from the ground, but in point of fact, it's a basic exercise. You then do rolls, if you can, which is an exercise where you go roll the aircraft through 360 degrees on its back and on the top, which is not easy in a Tagamoth in a biplane because you don't have really enough power. But you do it by simply going along, turning over. You turn the aircraft over by, in my case, I use right-handed, so I use right-handed rolls, to turn the aircraft over, hard over. Now, that immediately means the aircraft's going to do that. The moment it does that, it wants its nose to go down. So as it goes down, you put on top rudder, or put on left-hand rudder, opposite rudder, and you actually fly it around that circle until when you're upside down, you're putting the stick forward because you're flying upside down and going through that, and you're still turning with the, oh God, it's a mix of foot and hand and the coordination really, until you've gone upside down, and then you've got to get it round to the top, keep going round. Oh dear, it's a mechanical, it's an instinctive thing, mechanical really. But the first time you do it, you lose height and your nose go down and everything else, and it's all chaos. But you come out of it, you know. And you don't do that near the ground ever, unless you have a thing like a jet, where you can turn it round on its axis quite easily, and it returns. But an aircraft like a Tagamoth has got to be flown round a roll. So that's that one. Where are we? Aerobatics we did, steep turns, cross-country, which I've told you about now, a cross-country test, instrument flying, right. We're now in the situation where we're flying an aeroplane, but suddenly it gets foggy. You haven't on the horizon, you're in a cloud, and the only thing you've got to fly by are your instruments. Early days, you fly on instruments and you've got the world around you. Later on, you have a hood put over you. But that's later on. Now, all you have to do then is to be able to fly an aircraft on the instrument alone. Now, this is a very, very basic thing. First of all, you're no longer using your normal acuities of visuality, except that you're looking at instruments which tell you things. And it's one of the fundamentals that every pilot has to recognize, is that when you're flying blind or on instruments, you must believe the instruments at all times, because they're the only ones that tell the truth. Your bottom doesn't mean a thing, because you can feel your sidings slipping or all sorts of things in the aircraft. If the aircraft says you're not, and I'll deal with this later on in a unique experience in a hurricane, that's by the way. So you instrument flying, you have three basic things. You have your compass to find which way you're going. You have your altimeters to find how high you are. You have which shows whether you are climbing or descending, and this has a relationship with your turn and bank indicator, and they're all interrelated, and you have to read them all together. So we're now in a situation where an aeroplane is going forward at 85 miles an hour, its stalling speed's 45, you're going straight because your compass isn't turning, you're not climbing because your altimeter's not showing you're rising or falling, your height is fixed, so you know you've got 2,000 or 3,000 feet between you and the concrete below you. Your airspeed indicator is there so that you do anything wrong. Your turn and bank indicator shows whether you're flying properly. And if you're turning, and the bottom little pointer is away from the centre, it shows you're slipping sideways and not flying properly. So you're in a turn, which isn't a proper turn, and you would be able to see something on your compass, and so it goes on. So we have also, sitting in there, you have your throttle control, your gas boost and everything else. I'm dealing with other aircraft now, but you have a throttle control anyway. You have your rev counter, which shows what revolutions are doing. Oh dear, I can't remember all the other things, but I'll remember them later on if necessary. But so suddenly in a different environment where you're not in touch with the real world outside, except what's happening in front of you. It is in this circumstance that you cannot do aerobatics. This I promise you. But you may do some that are not on the record. That's by the way. So really it's so fundamental that if you're flying blind and you want to go somewhere, you're either going a straight line or you turn onto another straight line to go somewhere else. You either want to be higher or lower. You don't know what the ground is down below. It might be mountains up to 5,000 or 6,000 feet. So you know that you're not going to go below 6,000 or 7,000 feet if there's mountains around. And really, if you're by yourself, you just have to know what's around you. And if it's in cloud, all you know is it's cloudy. If you are flying blind on instruments without the hood over you so you can see outside, in a cloud you're flying in a fog, and the fog can vary from misty to being bloody thick, and in between that there are layers of cloud where you have thick cloud and there's suddenly nothing in between, so you fly between clouds, or you're in Clumius where you're flying through a series of clouds, you're in and out of one. And every time you go into one, it's a bump and out of another. Or if you're in cumulonimbus conditions, where that's major rainstorms, you could fly into a cumulonimb and lose the lot because your instruments go completely and utterly and you can't believe them. I kid you not. So, and that is a story that I can tell you later on in its context, where I went and did just that. So, really, you are learning to use the instruments and obey the instruments. They can be deceptive. You could say you're going down in a steep spiral turn, where you're going downwards. And you think, well, if you're going downwards, because your ultimate is going down, the only way to stop that is pull back on your stick to get upwards. No, because in a spiral dive, going down faster and faster, you're pulling along, and you're getting into a high-speed stall condition, which you're not taught in Tiger Moss, but that's hairy, okay? And once you're in cloud, it does... You're playing with something that lies to you. Really does. So you go back really to primaries, and I'll tell you about that later on. But this is the first indication of flying blind.
How is the flying blind the blind flying instruction carried out?
Well, first of all, you're just told to look in the cockpit and fly on the instrument. Bearing in mind, you're sitting in the back. The instructor's in the front. He can see what's going on, and you're just flying on the instruments. And he tells you what to do. You've got your... I can't remember there, that damn thing. Communication. So he tells you what to do while you're looking at your instruments. You don't look, he might take you into cloud, which will take you, make certain that you're not... But it's really a preliminary check that you can use instruments in a no visual situation. Then, when you've done that, they put there's a hood over. You can pull a hood over, and you fly in the dark in the instruments. You can write the instruments up, and you can see. And he tells you to do things, and you do them. He puts you into situations where you've got to get out of them. You've got to watch your instruments, see how you can get into them. And ultimately, you realise that you can't believe your bottom in your seat because you might be pressing the one, and it's the wrong sort of pressure on your bottom. And it's instruments, instruments all the time. And you learn this, and you learn it. If you fail to learn it, you're a disaster waiting to happen. Not to everybody, it doesn't happen to everybody, but when it does happen, it's not funny. In the extreme, I mean, talking of blind flying is nothing, that's easy. And you go from that ultimately, blind flying and circuits and bumps coming into land and this sort of thing. In fact, you go through a stage later on. I don't remember in a tiger moth, but certainly probably at next stage two, where you actually come into land blind, can do it quite easily. That you would set your position on your altimeter. You can set your relation to the zero in relation to the aerodrome level. You can adjust that. But if you don't know where it is, you've got a little bit of a problem to land blind. But if you're landing in fog, for instance, you don't know and you've got to take a punt. Maybe you don't, you know, who never knows. But you shouldn't get into that situation. I don't know. These are experiences that you can... I could react to it mentally, but I can't understand how we react to it in these conditions. Okay, so we've done all this, taken off into enlightened landing, medium turns. We've done spinning again, powered approach and landing, precautionary landings, deep turns, climbing turns. Climbing turns are a critical thing because if you're climbing in the turn with the engine on, you're obviously going upwards. But as you're going upwards, your engine power has got to hold the engine. You're losing flying speed unless you're maintaining it. And you're in a classic spin situation. Because if you go up with full power on and go up too fast, so your speed drops off, and then you drop away, you're in a spin with the engine going lickety-split. So you've got to know how to get out of that. And obviously you close everything away, you're spinning, you don't worry about it because you've got plenty of room. You stop the engine... put on opposite rudder, you know which way to put on rubber, full opposite rudder, the spin stops, you're going straight, then you're straight, go down, open your throttle away, engine starts powering again, and away. If your engine doesn't power again, you've got a problem because you've got a forced landing or a precautionary. You do everything to try and get the engine going. If you can't, forced landing, find a field, and ring up home and say, I'm in a field. Fairly straightforward, really. Side slipping we've done, steep turns, climbing turns, instrument flying, air navigation with map reading, and that was in the May the 9th. So we're talking about, we're getting to map reading and having done spinning and everything else from the 21st of April to the 9th of May. So that's 18 days.
Quite an intensive course by the sound that you're at first course.
Yeah, you're right, and you're tired. One thing about it is you're always tired. It takes a lot out of you mentally, and you slept like a log, and it was very tiring. But, and this is again a difference, I don't know about this stage was probably very tiring, but once you've gone solo and you're doing all the other things and getting more familiar, then you went ashore at night into the flesh pots of Birmingham, and that was disgraceful. the Swan at Yardley was the place we go, which is a pub with a great, oh dearie me, and you had to fly the next day, of course, and there were girls there, and you made a lot of girlfriends, which is another situation which we can deal with away from the flying. But if we're dealing with flying first, we've got through the situations where you are comfortable flying a tiger moth. In other words, you can go into a tiger moth, you can take it from A to B, you can read a map, you hang on to it because it blows through the wind, you've got a problem. But that's always the way it goes.
And how did you feel about, obviously, learning to fly? You'd attained what you'd set out to do, really, hadn't you, when you joined the Fleet Air Arm? So how did you feel finally sort of going solo and getting more comfortable with an aircraft?
I just like being in an airplane. Just simple as that. I enjoyed it. It was a problem. It had been a problem to start. It was a problem to resolve. And it was a problem that stayed with you for the rest of your flying life, because you always have a different aircraft, different problems, different conditions, service flying particularly. So I enjoyed it. It was never taken away from me. I was frightened. I was feared. But I was never... I never hated flying. It's probably the best way to say it. I had... it was never a problem. It never worried me. See people when they were going off, even when they've been flying a long time, the takeoff was a worry, you know, going to the aircraft. Never a problem at all.
It's interesting you say that, because with some of your fellow flying colleagues, did they all attain that kind of sense of lack of problem, or did some of them never quite get the feel for it?
I can't speak for others, but knowing people I've met over a period of time, there are some people who never got accustomed to it. Some were people who are flying against the nature, which is not a good thing. But they were identified. The selection process and the program you went through identified these problems, but because you been taught to fly, you weren't thrown out with the baby in the bathwater. And you got a lot of, at this stage, you got a lot of First War pilots. So we're talking about 1919 now, where people were probably 20, 25. The war is now another 20 years on, so they're 40 coming back into flying. And that's a transition that is hard to take, because they'd never flown before, and we met up with a lot of them in Scotland later on, because they were never comfortable really flying. Difficult to describe, but they'd come back thinking, oh yes, I'd like to fly again, and I can understand that feeling because I've been through it myself, but they were not happy doing it. I did it, and I was happy doing it. There's a different attitude, I think. And I did that because I came back after the end of World War II, back into flying after a layoff of, 6 years. And back into flying, I enjoyed it. And it was part of my life from then on, you know, and I was lucky.
What about your instructors? Did you have one instructor through your...
Bennett was my instructor most of the time. He was a flying officer. He was not a PO pilot. He was a nice guy, very good indeed. And he stayed as my instructor all the time. I never changed until I was cleared by the... That's right. I don't know whether... at this time, in June, we were also put on to Link training, of course. Training in Link for blind flying. And so before you actually did instrument flying, you were trained on a Link trainer, which was an aircraft cockpit, automated, so you could fly turns, flying courses, fly directions, and record them on a piece of paper, and you got a grid. And I did 6 hours in that, according to my logbook. By the 13th of June, that's 2 months, isn't it, from the 21st of April, I'd done 6 hours flying on instruments in the Link trainer. So that was all part and parcel of the course. You tend to forget these things. And I ended up with... I was passed by a chief flying instructor's average proficiency. No faults in flying, which is rather useful. And that meant that I could go somewhere else, I think. I think that pretty well deals with all the aspects of the flying, climbing turns, spinning, aerobatics, which is something that once you know the principles and from beyond a spinning through a loop to doing rolls and stall turns, which is quite an interesting exercise where you fly up to the zero gap to a rule in a vertical syndrome, and when you're on the top you put on full rudder to the right and you come down in a stall condition and come flying in. A nice pleasant thing to do. That was a special taking off into wind, gliding approach from landing. Always an interesting thought that when you're flying a biplane like that, very effective by crosswinds. Because if you have a strong wind blowing and you're trying to taxi, you've got a rudder there that's blowing on your thing against the, and it's not easy. And when you're coming into land, you're coming with a slight crosswind across the airfield. You don't fly straight, you're flying into wind, and you're going crabwise into the airfield. And then when you come in, you plonk yourself down straight, and then you run on. Bear in mind, you've got to take account of the crosswind on your rudder in a situation where your steering is entirely rudder as going forward. So that's another aspect of training, for what it's worth. Taking off and landing out and in, into and out of wind. And that was a continuous situation, really. I noticed that particularly, you were supposed to make a note every time you went up and did spinning in the aircraft. This was to be not one of the rules, because it starts from day one when we did a spin, and spinning and low flying were always underlined to show how much you did. And I did a final test with Squadron Leader Nugent after I'd done 51 hours dual and solo, half and half, 50-50. So that was my passing, and that by that time I'd done 75 flights in an aircraft. So at that time, whenever I went up to do solo by myself, to self-flying, go and do things, I did spinnings and aerobatics, as I've been taught previously, and that continued right through to the last few days, taking and landing where there were minor things. My cross-country test where I flew to North Luppenham, I don't even know where that is now. low flying, spinning, low flying, all by myself. And that's where I got into this low flying of my myself. spinning.
That was golf course incident.
Part of the golf course situation. But when you were low flying, you flew over everything anyway. You know, the golf course was always best because of people flying off there, and a nice piece of green grass underneath.
Were there anything you'd have to particularly look out for while you were low flying?
Yep, your airspeed, because it's easy to lose your airspeed by, because you're holding the throttle most of the time, and you're probably just looking around, and you do this and lose your flying speed at that stage. That I think is the danger. You don't deliberately fly below the level of objects anyway, but they can appear. And some people did silly things. There's a boy over on the course at Luton. They were flying Magisters, which are monoplanes, and he threw the brickworks by the brickworks, and hit one of the chimneys there, threw between chimneys, and he hit one of them, and it took a wingtip off his aircraft, and it wasn't a fool. It was still flying. I'll tell you another story about him in a minute. It's still flying, but he thought, broken the aircraft. I've got to explain this. He did a precautionary landing in a field, and when he got back, he said he had to precautionary landing because part of his aircraft fell off. Only to be dismayed by the fact that the brickyard broke to the airfield, saying, "We're awfully sorry, but one of our aircraft flew over us, and this came off, and it sent a piece of the wing back." So that was, he did all right. It was a story, was he, when he landed, he did a forced landing, a precautionary landing, and he stuffed some grass in the intake to show that he'd done a forced landing.